Blog Talk Radio.
Rah. Killer Mike Bamboo. You already know. Yeah. No surprise, I'm from a gangbang culture, but we can keep it civil or pull a thang-thang on ya. Southern California where the sun don't quit, intergenerational gang so sons don't quit. But immediately you see that the problems that's in my city are secondary to what's propelling it in my city. I mean really break it down, take poor black and brown, educate them poor, take the jobs from out the town. Then inundate them with the date of drugs and dumb TV, locked into a zoo and hunted daily by the police. Then you get a group of youth who know they don't belong, then they gather up and organize a number up strong. But see, the failure isn't seeing that the problem ain't the gang, it's the situation in the communities where we hang. So I'm so pro-gang, it might scare a motherfucker, cause I fixed the misconception that the enemies are brothers.
Bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, upset the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, homie, we been set up.
I tell them, I went from a street gang thing, then I joined a military fleet marine force thing. From a little bitty gang in the south of Los Angeles to dragging bodies out of their house to help a government who hell bent on keeping money spent on the missile. The reality's the difference between them shits is little. We had the objective of arming up over money, and they had the objective of arming up over money. And we told kids join us, we the truth. Lies about protecting our block to get recruits. Then we found out we getting killed for a hood, and we don't own a single speck of dirt on that hood. Whether in a zone down south in Decatur, or in a flatlands off of Lenox and La Brea, or in a low-rise project in Chicago, big money come in and buy up our body.
So your sets up, we about to upset the setup.
We about to upset the setup.
Up to upset the setup.
Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup.
Upset the setup.
Up to upset the
I
setup.
I do it for the Crips and the Blooders. BGF brothers, the real Freeway Ricky Ross and Chris Dutter. I do my thing for Hoover, I represent for Ford. So my folk and my people, so they set to support. Support a Mina Matthew, she might say the shot. So maybe next summer, no mama's gotta cry. Cause maybe next summer, nobody gotta die. Hell, even if we fail, somebody gotta try. The only way the system rule is somebody gotta lie. And the lie they told is old, they base it on your race. They separate you black, you brown, you yellow, and white face. Then we further separate by joining gangs and legislate. That our neighborhoods are now at war like we are separate states. So the police occupy our hood to keep down all the drama. So the Starbucks they just built is comfortable for soccer mama. And American Apparel comfortable for all the hipsters. And it's zero tolerance for all you spicks and you niggas and you chinks and you crackers. And it ain't about who's whiter and it ain't about who's blacker. But the money is a factor, and the factor is the factories got moved up out the hood. When starvation is present and absent is a job, a man with simple scars, or he will form a mob. If you should form a mafia, then you should think Sicilian. Buy the hood for real, every block, every field, every build,
every build.
Feed the chill,
feed the chill.
Gang bang,
gang bang.
Build,
build.
Feed the chill,
feed the chill.
Feed the chill,
feed the chill.
Gang bang,
gang bang.
On the system,
on the system.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mitch Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson,
sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today.
TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Good evening. Free land, revolutionary greetings. I'm your host, Bumar Shakir, for Georgia University Radio. The Georgia University has five goals. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transform the criminal mentality to new African mentality through educational means. The fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fourth goal is to free new African prisoners for relief, reduce new African recidivism. And the overall goal is to transform the whole of the prison slave complex, which is the prison system, to take advantage of teaching and learning through educational means. As we prepare brothers and sisters to enter the quote-unquote free world or free cipher and come to the community and create program institutions needed for people need. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'd like to go over some events that happened in history during this week. On September 10th, 1854, John Mercer Langston became the first new African to hold elected office in the U.S. In 1886, Georgia Dudley Johnson, the poet, was born. In 1914, George W. Buckner, a physician from Indiana, named minister to Liberia. In 1930, Charles E. Mitchell, certified public accountant and banker for West Virginia, named minister to Liberia. In 1956, in Kentucky, the public schools became integrated. In 1962, the Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black vacated an order of a lower court ruling that the University of Mississippi had to admit James H. Meredith, a new African Air Force veteran whose application for admission had been on the file in the courts for 14 months. In 1974, Guinea-Bissau gained independence from Portugal. In 1976, Mordecai Johnson, the first new African president of Howard University, died in Washington at the age of 86. On September 11, 1851, in the shootout in Christiana, Pennsylvania, new African dispersed slave catchers. One white was killed and another was wounded. The Christiania Rebellion is first recorded open resistance to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law. In 1885, Moses A. Hawkins, minister and educator, named Minister of Liberia. In 1895, South Carolina convened a state constitutional convention with the explicit purpose to disenfranchise new Africans. In 1953, J.A. Jackson, pastor of the Olivet Baptist Church in Chicago, elected president of the National Baptist Convention at a Miami meeting. In 1962, two youths involved in voter registration drive in Mississippi were wounded by a shotgun blast fired through the window of a home in Ruleville. James Foreman of the Student Nonviolent Quarter Committee sneaked at the president to convene a special White Hall conference to discuss the wave of terror sweeping through the South, especially where SNCC is working on voter registration. In the year 2000, U.S. Department said there were major disparities in death sentences handed out in federal court. The report said that of the 183 inmates for whom prosecutors had asked the death penalty in 1998, 50% were New African, 30% were Hispanic, and 20% were white. Okay. On September 12, 1748, some sources say the father of the black masonry, Prince Hall, was born. Prince Hall Day is typically celebrated around the 14th with a revision at time called to the Most Worshipful Grand Lodge. In 1924, the world witnessed the born day of an African revolutionary, cultural revolutionists, agriculturalists, scientists, military genius, America Cabral. In 1948, the world witnessed the birth of Bawa Messiah Hosea, a former new African political prisoner, a former of the Black Liberation Army, the Amistad Collective, a former of the Black Panther Party, Amira Mazie Arakaba, and so much more. Deputy Minister of Information for the Republic of Africa, Acting Mayor Jericho Amnesty, and et cetera, a man in many hats. 1956, new African students entered Clay, Kentucky Elementary School under National Guard protection. They were barred from the school on September the 17th. In 1966, white mobs attacked new African students who are attempting to integrate schools in Grenada, Mississippi. 1974, Haile Selassie deposed by military leaders after 58 years at the Emperor of Ethiopia. On September 3rd, 1977, Stephen Biko, leader of the Black Country Movement, was assassinated by South African government while in prison. On September 13, 1663, one of the first serious slave conspiracies in colonial America, a plot of white servants and new African slaves in Gloucester County, Virginia, were betrayed by an indentured servant. 1867, Major General E.R.S. Canby ordered South Carolina court to impanel new African jurors. 1885, Alan L. Locke, the first new African Rhodes Scholar, was born. In 1907, the annual conference of the Methodist Power Church in Michigan votes against ordaining new African bishops. In 1962, Mississippi Governor Ross R. Barnett defied the federal government in an impassioned speech on statewide radio television hookup, saying the world interposed the authority of the state between the University of Mississippi and federal judges who had ordered the admission of James F. Meredith. Barnett said, there is no case in history where the Caucasian race has survived social integration. He promised to go to jail if necessary to prevent integration at the state university. His defiance set the stage for the gravest federal state crisis since the Civil War. Interesting. In 1971, U.S. troops murdered 32 prisoners at Attica Prison. The prisoner would demonstrate for human rights in regard to the Attica Rebellion. In 1972, which actually was motivated by the assassinated Comrade George Jackson, August 23rd, 1971. 1972, Johnny Ford of Tuskegee and A.J. Cooper of Pritchard elected mayors in Alabama. In 1996, Country Rapid City, Tupac Marshall Kill, was assassinated. On September 14, 1874, white Democrats seized State House in Louisiana, Coup d'Etat. President Grant ordered the revolutionaries to disperse and the rebellion collapsed. 27 persons, 16 whites and 11 new Africans were killed in battle between Democrat and Republicans. 1921, Constance Baker Motley, the first new African woman before the federal judge, is born. In 1920, the Harlem Renaissance, which is a new African culture movement of authors and artists, began. In 1970, from the 14th to 15th, one new African killed and two whites injured in shootout between activists and police officers in New Orleans Housing Project. They were known as the Showdown and Desiree. And this is a personal account I'm going to read. The police came shortly at 8:30 a.m. just as the winds from nearby tropical storm Felice turned up a black covered cloud that dumped a downpour of rain on the troubled Desire neighborhood. Several hundred New Orleans policemen and 20 or 30 state policemen descended on the organization headquarters, a large old frame building decorated with the posters of Panther heroes. That was a statement from the newspaper, New York Times, September 15th. Now, this is according to Malik Raheem, one of the elders of the Black Panther Party of New Orleans. According to Malik Raheem, a Panther who was there, there were 12 of us in the party, officers at the time. Almost 100 police with everything from the city caliber machine gun and an armed car down to their revolver. We had about 9 shotguns and a couple of handguns, .357 revolver. Everything we had was legally purchased or registered to our office. Our position was that new Africans should no longer be lynched or beaten or attacked and had their rights taken away without any form of resistance. We believe that you have a right to defend yourself. You have a right to defend your community, your right to defend your family. You have a right to defend your honor as a human being. Raheem continued describing the shootout to me these 33 years later. The police came in busloads. They got into position and just started shooting. They shut up in the office maybe 20 minutes straight. It seemed like it was all day, I said. Boy, they're going to kill us. The The fire would come in so fast, we literally had to pour water on the walls because you could see the sheetrock expanding from the heat till you could touch it. And he touched it, and it was just pop. The tear gas came in constantly. As fast as we could throw it out, we put bread in a wet towel. The yeast in the bread helped with the tear gas. The front door weighed about 300 pounds. There was a 15-year-old in the house who the Panther hadn't been able to get out before the shooting started. When he stood up abruptly, someone attacked him and said, "Get down, fool." Second later, the place where he had been standing was riddled with bullets. After about 3 or 4 minutes, Charles, a 19-year-old Panther leader, asked Malik to crawl into the different room and find out how many were injured and how many were dead. I went to the first room and said, "Malik," I asked, "how many people in here are shot? How many is dead?" Ron told me, "Ain't nobody in here shot or dead." I called the next room. Leah and T, I asked them, "Nobody shot or dead. Elaine and Ed, who shot and who's dead? Nobody. The back room, Kathy and Brokey, who shot, who dead? Nobody." I went back to Charles and he said, "Who they done killed?" I said, "Nobody," he said. "What, all the shooting and they ain't shot nobody?" I said, "No." And we all bust out laughing. He said, well, we done did all we can do in here. Now we got to take it to court. Say everybody to come down." I said, "No, I ain't going to let them take me out anywhere and hang me, beat me to death. Whatever they're going to do to me, they're going to do it to me right here." Charles said, "That's not what we're here for. We're going to come out of here as men and women, and we're going to take it to the court. Whatever happened from there happened. If they take us out of here and kill us, everybody in this community, they're going to know what happened because we're going to walk out of here as men and women." They all got up in the second room, and Charles gave one of the greatest inspirations Malik had ever heard. He said, "We're the Black Panther Party. We aren't going to bow down. We aren't going to allow anybody to degrade us or what we stand for. We're going to let everybody know that we stand for our rights as human beings, and we're going to take it to the court. If they convict us, we're going to let everybody know that in this country, there are two kinds of justice. They're just for the rich and powerful, and they're injustice for the poor and the disenfranchised. When you walk out of that door, everybody raise their hand and holler power to the people." And we did. Next caller will tell the story of running how Malik almost didn't make it to court. They're from the book called Should I Desire, Panthers, People, Panther, Pirates, and Police, story of the Black Panther New Orleans 1970, as told to Arisha Wren by people who were there. So that was a little about that in regard to their history. Okay, on September the 15th to 20th, 1876, white terrorists attacked Republican in Ellington, South Carolina, two white and 39 youth Africans were killed. In 1923, the governor said Oklahoma was in a state of rebellion and insurrection because the Ku Klux Klan activities had put the whole state under martial law. 1963, four new African girls killed in bomber a 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. 1964, Reverend K.L. Buford and Dr. Stanley Schmier were elected to Tuskegee City Council and became the first new African elected official in Alabama in the 20th century. In 1973, Black Panther Party member Veronica Powell was captured, and her brother Steve had enemy land right to the day. And a petition floating on right now, trying to petition to get him out. You can find it online. September 16, 1889, Claude A. Barnett, founder of the Associated Negro Press, was born. In 1940, Selective Training Selective Act addressed discrimination in armed forces. In 1979, considered the first commercially successful hip-hop single, Rapper's Delight by Sugarhill Gang were released. Now, those are the events that happened in history during the week. Of course, there are many more, but the show will continue. First, I'd like to thank everybody who joined our broadcast in 2014. Thank everybody who's been supporting Georgia University, the ones who've been supporting our work that we're doing in the community, our pamphlet, leaflet, and I always know that that we have our founders of New Avenue Political Prisoners. They need our support. There's a petition floating around for our founder, co-founder Adu Lugabashkir, who's our chairman, who's our chancellor, floating around for Joker Hashim and Jensei, who's our vice chancellor. I'm a vice chancellor as well. That you can find online for the New Avenue Political Prisoners, as for all New Avenue Political Prisoners in general, Captain New Avenue Citizen, New Avenue POW. I want to salute everybody who currently organizing, educating, and advocating their community, respectfully, whether it's in their family, the ones that are doing the work all around the board. And without all ado, I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Bobo Malik. Free the land. How you doing, brother?
Free the land, Brother Shakur.
by me necessary. How you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be on the planet. I'm always in a state of gratitude, to tell you the truth.
Yes, sir. That's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing, man. First, I'll say thank you for the work you did in the past, present, and the future. You know what I'm saying? Before you even start, you know what I'm saying? About taking the time, your schedule, so you're now to understand your experiences. Thank you for the cause you're doing. The first thing I want you to do, you know,
and
tell
the
people
and
about
the same thing, same thing back at you. Same thing back at you, and it's my responsibility. It's my responsibility to add whatever value I can to the work that you're doing.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that, Bob. No doubt. That's a good thing, man. I appreciate that. That knowledge, man, recognition. First, I would like you tell the people about your background, the ones who are listening now, the ones who listen in the future, so they can know exactly who's talking, where you're coming from, some of who you are, you know, a little bit about your background, what you got going on, what do you do, what you're involved with, so forth and so on. So give them a bio of yourself, if you don't mind.
Okay. So maybe what I'll do is I'll start with what I'm doing now, and then I'll go backwards and talk about kind of how I got started. Presently, I serve as the executive director of an organization called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And we are concerned about the situation that black people find ourselves in throughout the world, in this country and throughout the world. And throughout the interview, I'll use the term black and new African interchangeably. So just to preface my remarks with that. So we're concerned about the fact that for the most part, we're being fed by white people and Arabs and Asians. And that's true whether it's in Detroit, it's true whether it's in Alabama, whether it's in California, whether it's in Jamaica, whether it's in various parts of Africa. We've been put into a dependent situation, and part has to do with our history, you know, in this country, in the so-called Western Hemisphere, the history of our people being enslaved. Many of our people still associate agricultural work with enslavement or sharecropping. And so many of our people don't want to have anything to do with it. So that's part of the struggle that we're faced with as we try to figure out how to get out of this food dependence that we find ourselves. But anyway, so that's why we exist. And specifically in Detroit, we're concerned about the fact not only that many of our people don't have access to high-quality food, and that lack of access to high-quality food results in our life being shortened and the quality of our life being diminished. And so that's one aspect of it. But then the other aspect of it is in Detroit, an ethnic minority from Iraq called Chaldeans owns probably 90% of the grocery stores in the city. There's about 70 grocery stores in the city that are smaller independent stores. There's no real chain stores in Detroit except for Whole Foods. And then there's a regional chain called Myers that has 3 stores in Detroit. But there's lots of areas that don't have a grocery store nearby. But 90% of these independent grocery stores, which are the majority in Detroit, are owned by Chaldeans. And, of course, Detroit is definitely one of the blackest cities in North America in terms of our percentage of the overall population. You know, we're about 80% of the population. And so it's just, you know, it's a shame and a crime that we would allow ourselves to continue to be in the situation where other people come and open these grocery stores in our community, and we just go pour millions of dollars into their coffers. And it's just like, actually, Malcolm said this in the early 1960s. He said, even when we spend our money in our own community, you know, we can exploit it. And I'm paraphrasing Malcolm. I'm not quoting him exactly. And he said, you know, because the merchants in our community are not from our community, at the end of the day, when the sun goes down, that merchant leaves with a basket full of money and goes to the other side of town or to the suburbs. And all that money is just drained out of our community, leaving us in a further dependent situation and enriching other people. So for us, that situation is not acceptable. And so our organization was formed to address these things. And so we do a few things. We do farming. We run a 7-acre farm called D-Town Farm. where we grow about 3 dozen different vegetables, and we train people how to do urban agriculture. We also have 2 youth programs where we teach young people how to build raised bed gardens and how to harvest the foods, how to prepare them in healthy ways. And everything that we do is African-centered. It's rooted in the understanding that for our people to move forward in a sane way, we have to root whatever we do within our own culture, our own history, our own experience. And so while they're learning, these things about how you grow vegetables, they also learn about George Washington Carver, who we call the patron saint of organic agriculture. Or they're learning about the Yam Festival in Nigeria or in Ghana. And so, you know, really trying to give our young people a sense of national consciousness and a sense of Pan-African consciousness. So that permeates everything that we do. And then the thing that we've been working on for about 13 years is finally coming to fruition, is we are spearheading the building of a building, a two-story building called the Detroit Food Commons, that will house the Detroit People's Food Co-op, a cooperative community-owned grocery store that we have been working on since 2010 and is scheduled to open in February of next year. So that's what I'm doing now. And I'm a musician. I play guitar. I lead a band called Molly Wop that plays conscious music. And we've been playing around Detroit quite a bit for the last about 9 years. Now, my backstory is I was born in 1956. And as I was listening to you run through the different historical events, and one event you mentioned in 1956, I was just thinking about how really I was born in the thick of, you know, of our people's struggle. The, you know, so-called civil rights struggle was ramping up at that point in time. And really the trajectory of my life, in a sense, was defined by the struggle of our people for freedom. So by 1967, I'm 11 years old, and Detroit has a rebellion, the bloodiest of the urban rebellions that happened across America in the 1960s. So 43 people were killed in a 5-day period, and the U.S. Army came in, paratroopers came in. In fact, Geronimo Pratt was one of the troops who was sent into Detroit. He was stationed on the east side of the city, and there was, I think, the 101st Airborne Division was on the west side of the city. So, you know, they were brought in to quell this rebellion. And so, you know, those are the things that shaped my mind as a youngster, as I'm moving into adolescence. You know, this is the time period that I'm living through. And, of course, on the national level, you know, you had black people all across this country protesting. You know, the Black Panther Party had developed here in Detroit. You know, Detroit is really the home of the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa, the home meaning, you know, the starting place of that. So even in my own neighborhood, President Imari Obadele lived about 4 or 5 blocks from me. His son, you know, went to the same school I went to. And so, you know, these ideas, you know, in Detroit at that time, it was a hotbed of black consciousness and black rebellion. And particularly, I went to a school called Post Junior High School. And I went there for the 8th and the 9th grade. And when I was in the 8th grade, I had 2 teachers who I want to actually call their names, Ronald McCombs and Melvin Peters. And these 2 brothers were from West Virginia, and they had moved to Detroit about 1966, and they were both teachers. And they ended up teaching in the same school. So one of the brothers was my social studies teacher, and his homeboy was my English teacher. And so they were very conscious brothers themselves, and they were only maybe at that time about 27. And so sometimes they would combine their classes together, and they would play Malcolm X records for us, or they would play a John Coltrane for us, or they would have speakers come in, or they would show us movies. And they were really trying to politicize us and radicalize us, which they did. And so, you know, I can trace really the beginnings of my consciousness to when I was in the 8th grade and they played in one of those sessions where the classes were combined, Malcolm X's Message to the Grassroots. And so after hearing that, my life has never been the same. So that kind of set me on the path of being a black nationalist. And, you know, I've been in the struggle for our people since that time.
It's a beautiful thing, man. You know, I can only imagine, you know, going into a public school setting, you playing Malcolm X or you listen to John Coltrane, you have people kind of speaking about nationalism and revolution and struggle and African history. You know, that's a whole different type of dynamic. And also to be able to be around what was taking place, going on with the rebellion was taking on in the 60s, especially in Detroit. You know, they gave birth to so many different beautiful movements. The Black Earth Movement, New African Independent Movement, right? Gave birth to so many movements.
Right.
That's a beautiful spirit of resistance to be around. You know, you mentioned some things earlier in regards to the organization you're part of, right? You know, what exactly is food security? What exactly does that mean? You know, food security. What does that mean?
Okay, yes.
How did y'all explain?
Thank you for asking that question. Thank you for asking that. So, food security is a concept that's used a lot internationally. It's used in the UN, and really, what it means, the term community food security, means when all of the members of a community have adequate amounts of culturally appropriate food. To break it down, what it means is that people aren't hungry. So if everybody in a community is free from hunger, then that community would be considered food secure. But I'm glad you asked that question, because we're actually in the process of changing the name of our organization, and we're going to publicly announce it at our Harvest Festival on September 23rd. And that is, we're changing it to Detroit Black Community Food Sovereignty Network. Because when we started out, we were familiar with the term food security. But then as we really started studying more what that term meant and what the term food sovereignty meant, we realized that our work is really more aligned with food sovereignty. So the difference between food security and food sovereignty, again, food security is basically people making sure that everybody has enough food to eat. But that's a low goal, especially in a country as wealthy as America. And one of my friends, an Indian brother named Raj Patel, told me once, he said, you can have food security in prison. And I thought about it, like, that is right. You know, you can have you can have adequate food to eat in prison. And so there's something more that we're struggling for besides just that. You know, that's a low bar, you know, and certainly everybody, you know, just the human right, the right of being a human being, you know, you have the right to adequate amounts of food. But still, that's a low bar. What food sovereignty is not only do we have the right to adequate amounts of food, but we have the right to exert our self-determination to define the system and control the system that provides our food, starting with what kind of foods are we going to eat? You know, are we eating a diet that was imposed on us by somebody else, which is the case for the most part? And unfortunately, these days with a lot of younger people, fast food is the predominant food that they're eating. So food sovereignty starts with deciding, you know, what plants, what vegetables do we want to plant? What kind of animals do we want to raise? How are we going to raise these vegetables and animals? Are we going to raise them organically with respect for the earth and in line with our own tradition and culture? Or are we going to raise them in the way that American conventional agriculture raises them, which is using lots of chemicals, destroying the environment, raising animals that are sick? You know, we have to define that food system. And part of defining the food system also means that we put in place the infrastructure so that we're controlling everything from the seed to the table. And so what that means is you got farmers, you got people who raise the food, you got people who are wholesalers who buy from farmers, you got people who are distributors, you have retail stores, you know, where people come and buy these things, and then you have the consumer, the person who buys it. And so right now, where we fit into the equation is just on the end of the equation, the consumer. For the most part, that's, the, you know, there are still, I want to acknowledge, there are still black farmers, And there are, you know, there's a growing movement where we have many more young people farming. But for the most part, the food that ends up on our table was not grown by black people. And so the food sovereignty is controlling that whole process, but also making sure that the people who are spending the money on the food, who are buying the food, that they have benefit from the money that they spend, that it's not being extracted from their community, but the money is circulating within our community to create wealth, prosperity, and power. And so that's the difference. That's what food sovereignty is. And really, to tell you the truth, one of the reasons I like the term food sovereignty is because black people need sovereignty in general. You know, food. If we get people focused on food sovereignty, then that's a gateway to get them focused on the bigger issue of sovereignty, that we need to be governing ourselves and controlling ourselves on every level, not just food. That's an important aspect, but we need to have sovereignty on every level. And so so that's the difference in food security and food sovereignty.
Yeah, I appreciate that. My next question is, right, where actually the benefits of having your own New African grocery store and have your own New African food store in the community? What's the benefit of that? What does that actually look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say, one of my heroes you mentioned in the historical review at the beginning, that's Amilcar Cabral, and one of the things he said is "Tell no lies, claim no easy victories," and so that's always resonated with me, and so I don't want to make what I'm going to say overblown and make it seem like we've solved this problem or we had a solution to it. You know, we're taking baby steps. And so I want to be clear. I don't want to overblow, you know, at all what the reality is, because it's difficult work, you know. And so we need to know that. We need to acknowledge that, you know, if we're going through it idealistically, thinking this is easy work, that we end up burning out and giving up. So what's happening in Detroit, you know, I mentioned that we have a 7-acre farm, but there's many other black folks in Detroit who are also doing either farming or gardening. And so there's production farms like our farm. Our farm is really a production farm and a teaching farm and a community healing space, because we have events there as well. Some farms are just production farms. They're just growing stuff to take to the market, and that's how they earn their living. Maybe the farmer, a farmer and maybe his wife or something like that, or, you know, sometimes two women are running a farm, but they're using it as their means of income. That's another kind of farm. Then you have some farms that are some gardens that we call community gardens that might be in the middle of a community where residents in that community collectively work to grow the food in the garden. And usually that kind of garden, it's like you put in what you can and you take what you need. And so there's a lot of those. Then you have what's called allotment gardens. And this idea largely comes from Europe, where you might have a big garden space, but within that garden space, individuals or families get maybe a row or get one raised bed, and they tend to that all year. Maybe they pay a fee to do that. So all of those kind of things exist in Detroit, and also school gardens exist at several schools. And so, you know, you ask, what does it look like? Part of what it looks like is we're trying to have enough people growing food that we actually consume. And when I say that we actually consume, certain things we know our people are going to eat, like collard greens, for example. There's no reason in the world that we should be paying white people, Arabs, Asians for collard greens. This is something we know how to do, and we should be doing it. We know our people are going to eat sweet potatoes, onions, and tomatoes, and things like that. So we're trying to get enough people in enough parts of the city growing that this becomes a regular part of becomes a part of our culture, because it used to be part of our culture, where it's normalized that having, you know, gardens or on a neighborhood level or farms on a neighborhood level is just part of what life should be. And so that's part of how it looks. But then also you mentioned the grocery store, and we, you know, I talked earlier about how Chaldeans own 90% of stores in Detroit. And so, you know, I've been involved in protests at stores where you know, the store owner treats a black person, disrespects a black person, and then we go out there and we pick it, you know, or whatever. You know, I've been involved in several of those, and we can do that forever. But the bigger question for me is always, what are we going to do? How do we exhibit self-determination? How do we take our own situation into our own hands? And so that's what we did in creating the Detroit People's Food Co-op. And I'll also add into this discussion that our organization is an anti-capitalist organization, an anti-white supremacist organization. And so we're not trying to recreate a capitalist model in blackface. What we're trying to do is create a model based on cooperation and based on collective ownership that is more in line with our traditional culture, and it's also more in line with the type of society that we would like to see brought into being that is not based on the accumulation of capital in the hands of a few people, which, because white supremacy and capitalism are like evil twin sisters, it happens that those few people who are wealthy, whose hands the wealth is accumulated in, also are white. And so this is what frames our work.
True indeed. You know, we got a profane from a spirit of Ujima, a spirit of Ubuntu, and a spirit of communalism of God dealing with our people. You know, because that's who we are. That's
right.
Our culture. That's who we are.
That's right. That's right.
You know, for people who are just at home, and they want to, what are some of the things they can do to want to get an understanding of food sovereignty at home? What are some things they can do? What are some things you can do for your home in regard to food sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. I would say one of the first things that we need to do, well, let me say this. The beginning of food sovereignty is breastfeeding. And so I would advocate strongly that we make that part of our culture, an important part of our culture, the standard, the norm, that babies are fed from the breast of their mothers. Now, you know, I'll acknowledge that some women can't breastfeed for various reasons, but many and probably most can. And there's nothing better that can be done for a child besides breastfeeding on several levels, on the level of the psychological security of the child, as well as on the nutrient level for the child. So it begins there. And even that requires a shift in our mindset, you know, from kind of what Western popular culture is promoting. So it begins there. But then also I would say people should look at their own diet. Now, I'll say personally, I'm a vegan. I don't eat meat, eggs, cheese, dairy products, fish, none of that myself. Although I'm not trying to impose that on anybody else, you know, and I think people are free to eat whatever they want to eat. But what I would say is that most people in America, and even those of us who consider ourselves to be conscious Africans or conscious New Africans, most of us have allowed ourselves to buy into this, what we call a standard American diet, which is heavy in meat, it's heavy in salt, it's heavy in oils, and it has a detrimental effect on our health. Our people are dying of rates of high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, at far higher rates than any other group in this country. And there's many reasons for it. I mean, one of the main reasons is oppression and the stress that oppression causes, but also our diets. And so we need to really carefully examine our diets. And again, I'm not suggesting people become vegans, but we need to look at how much meat do we eat? You know, do you have to have meat with every meal? Does meat have to be the center of the plate? And then as you begin to reduce the consumption of meat, how can you add more fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, whole grains into your diet? And then at the same time, how can you start eliminating a bunch of that stuff that's probably in the cabinet, in cans, in packages, in styrofoam containers, that's got all kind of preservatives in it and artificial colorings in it, and it may taste good and it may be cheap to buy, but it's destroying our health. And so we can start by being conscious eaters and taking control of what we eat. And really, for me, this journey towards becoming a vegan actually started with that same Malcolm X speech that I heard in 1969, when Malcolm was, one of the things he talked about is he said there were two types of slaves, the field slave, the house slave, and the field slave. And he said the house slave ate high up on the hog, and the field slave ate kind of whatever was left, the insides of the hog. And he said back then, them days, they called them what they were, guts. And he said that's what you were, a gut eater. And he said some of y'all are still gut eaters today. Now, this shook my mind at 13 years old because my very favorite food in the world was chitlins. And so I love chitlins. And, you know, my mother would make them only once a year on New Year's Day, and we put hot sauce on them, and I loved them. And so to hear Malcolm put my very favorite food within a historical context and me to start to begin to understand that the reason my mother made chitlins was because her mother made chitlins, and the reason her mother made chitlins was because her mother, who was enslaved, made chitlins. And so much of our diet has come down to us from our enslavement. Now, at the same time, I want to affirm the genius of our people because those chitlins got us through. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to in any way degrade our people for the food that we ate because we took whatever we had and we made the best of it and often made delicacies. But as we mature and grow as a people, you know, we have to mature and grow. Some things we have to leave behind. So the first step is like looking in your own cabinet and all that stuff that's junk and crap and got preservatives in it and it's not going to do your health any good. It's to get rid of it and start, you know, and not do it all at once. You know, if you're going to make a change, you need to do it gradually. The second thing I would suggest is that people begin to grow something, even if you just have a pot and you can grow one tomato plant. Because once you start, it gives you kind of a sensitivity for the work of agriculture, and it also puts you in a position where you have to care for and nurture something. And that's an important quality that we have to develop within ourselves, the ability to care for and nurture things. And there's dozens of lessons that agriculture can teach us about life. So, you know, grow a tomato plant, grow some herbs on the kitchen windowsill. If you got a backyard, you know, plant a small garden. You know, start small, though. People shouldn't start larger than what they can manage because, you know, it can easily, you know, gardening, agriculture can take a lot of work, you know, weeding in the summer and all that kind of stuff. So it's better to start small with something you can manage and then kind of build it up step by step.
Indeed. You know, for the people listening now, people listening in the future, who go by different African names and different appellations, right? Can you tell the people what exactly are your African names and what do they mean and why were they chosen?
Sure. Sure. Well, I'll start with by saying that the name I was given at birth was David Burton. And so, again, after hearing Malcolm, you know, a lot of things for me going back to this one speech here, Malcolm. But, you know, him talking about us carrying the names of our slave masters, and I started doing the research in my own family and found out that the name Burton was imposed on my family because there was an enslaver named Colonel Burton. He was a colonel in the Confederate Army, and all of the enslaved Africans on his plantation took the last name Burton. And so my grandfather's father was enslaved. My great-grandfather was enslaved. That, you know, that's how close it is. You know, people think, oh, why are y'all still talking about that? That was so long ago. My father's grandfather was enslaved. It wasn't that far back, you know. So he passed it. My great-grandfather passed the name to my grandfather. My grandfather passed it to my father. My father passed it to me. Then after becoming conscious, I was like, no, I'm putting an end to this. And so I wanted to make sure before I had any children that I changed my name from Burton. And so at the time, many of us, when we were changing our names, there were a few African name books that were circulating around. And to be honest, in retrospect, many times there were errors in those African name books. And we had men taking women's names, women taking men's names, mispronouncing names, you know, because you see it on paper, but the way something is actually pronounced in the language, you know, for example, you know, many people talk about the scholar Sheikh Anta Diop, they call it, D-I-O-P. But then I went to Senegal, and they teach me that the D-I sounds like a J. So his name is actually Sheikh Anta Diop. And so, you know, just mistakes like that, you can't really tell by just looking at a book with some words in it. And so many of us, you know, were taking names out of these books. And, you know, I just want to acknowledge that oftentimes there was some misinformation in those books. But I took the name Yakini, which is a name from East Africa that means truth, certainty, and assurance. And, you know, because those are attributes that I'm trying to manifest within my life. And the word Yakini really, as many words in Kiswahili in particular, has an Arabic root. About 30% of the words in Kiswahili have an Arabic root because Kiswahili was a trading language. It also has German words in it. A lot of people don't know that, like the word dashiki or shule. Those are actually German words. You know, they're not African words per se, but they were folded into Kiswahili. But anyway, so Yakini has an Arabic root, you know, meaning truth. And so, so you know, that's something I strive to live my life in tune with the truth. And I took that as my last name. My first name, Malik, I took not because I was Muslim, but because of the great honor and respect I give to Malcolm X. And, of course, his Islamic name was El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And many of us later found out he also had an African name he was given in Nigeria, Omawale. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so I took the name Malik because of my respect and honor and the role that Malcolm X played in my development. But the word Malik or Malik, as they say in Arabic, actually is an attribute in the Islamic religion. They say there's 99 attributes of Allah. And Malik or king is one of those attributes. And so within Islam, people would properly say the name is Abdul Malik, which means a servant of the king. So, in other words, you're not calling yourself the king. You're saying the Most High is the king, and you're trying to develop that kingly attribute within yourself and being a servant to that. So, you know, even though I'm not Muslim, that that kind of logic resonates with me also in terms of the meaning of the name. Then my middle name is Kenyatta. And this may well be one of these things that was incorrect in these African name books, but several of the books I saw said the name Kenyatta was a name from Kenny the musician. And so because I play guitar, I took that name. So that's, and I chose those names in 1975. But interestingly, in 1978, our beloved ancestor, Chokwe Lumumba, and our beloved brother, Jeff Edison, attorney Jeff Edison, and our beloved ancestor, Adam Shakur, they were law partners. And they developed an affidavit. They did some research, and they developed an affidavit where we paid them $10 for this affidavit and filled it out. And basically what it said is it was a name change affidavit. And so we would have African naming ceremonies. And at the end of the African naming ceremony, Chokwe would have the affidavits. You could pay $10, get it, you'd fill it out, and it basically said, I'm changing my name because, and you could write in the blank, you know, to affirm my cultural identity or to reject my slave name, or whatever you want to put in there. You can put there, and then it said, I'm not doing this to defraud anybody, and da-da-da-da-da. You had to list what your former name was. And then they had a notary public stamp it, and then they told us we had to take it to, and I don't remember the exact order, but we took it to the Secretary of State to get a, I think first we took it to Social Security and got a new, got our name changed on the Social Security card. Then you take that to voter registration, get your name changed on the voter registration. Then you take that to the Secretary of State and get it changed on your driver's license. So myself, my good brother, who's now ancestor, Kwame Kenyatta, who was, I believe, one of the founding members of the New African People's Organization, if not one of the founders, certainly he was a prominent member. In fact, we changed our name the same day. But several other people in Detroit did this without going through the American court system. And, you know, we were able to change our names, get it on our passports, the whole nine yards. So I changed my name and have never been in no courtroom to do it. But the system, evidently, they said we put an end to this. And at some point, I don't know exactly when, but they cracked down on it. Now they're forcing people, if you want to change your name, to go through their course and pay some like $700 or something like that. But I just wanted to lift up the genius of Brother Chukwe Lumumba and Brother Adam Shakur and Jeff Edison in developing this tool, which allowed us to affirm, you know, to exert our God-given right to name and define ourselves without having to go through our enemy's court. So so that's the story on that.
You know, that's an interesting story because I know I want to have a conversation with Mama Talon Bob Hay Kima from the RNA 11, who became a citizen in 1969. And they both shared that Chukwe Lumumba, the one that named them, gave them their African names in 1969, right? Which is a beautiful thing as well. Also, you had mentioned previously that in regards to the organization, the Food Security Network, that you mentioned that it was a youth component, right? And you said the youth are learning things about Washington Carver and so forth and so on, right? Other individuals, right? Now, how important and significant is it for the youth to obtain African-centered education? What is the significance of that?
Does that actually mean? It's critical. It's critical. And I really didn't even go into that. So for 21 years, I ran an African-centered school. I co-founded a school and ran it for 21 years. So I didn't even mention that when I was kind of at the beginning. And I'll say, and without going into the whole background, I'll just say in 1981, myself and about seven other people founded a school called Ensorama Institute. We started as an underground school, you know, because we weren't operating by no kind of laws and we didn't have no fire inspection and, you know, all the things that you're supposed to have to legally operate a school. We didn't have none of that. We just had the determination that it's our responsibility to educate our children. And so to tell you the truth, I was trying not to get into this, but I'll just give you a little background and say that several of us had been at another African-centered school in Detroit. And there was a conflict that ensued in the school that resulted in me getting put out of the school. And several other people pulled out because they felt the way I had been treated was unjust. And so we ended up starting another school. And so we started really out of a crisis. It's not like we had 6 months to sit down and plan a school. You know, we all of a sudden had 12 children who had been in this small African center school who were no longer in the school. And so we had to figure out what to do. Long story short, we started this school November 29th, 1989. With about 12 students, our own children, really. And eventually the school grew to 265 students. It became a charter school, which was controversial. I say a lot of our comrades, you know, felt that was the wrong move to make. And I don't want to get into that whole argument right now, but I'll say clearly we thought it was a good move at the time, and it allowed us to offer African-centered education to more of our people, because when we were a small private school, we had to charge tuition. And so even though the tuition was low, the average one of our families really can't afford to pay, especially if they got two or three children in school. And so when this charter opportunity came, it became an opportunity to offer this to more people and to people who couldn't afford to come to the school that required tuition. So, you know, so we operated from 1989 until the school closed in 2013. And ultimately being a charter school had to do with why it closed, but still I think it was the right move to make. And, you know, we educated thousands of children in this city, many of whom are now activists and out doing various types of good work in our community. And, you know, that's so you're asking, why is African Center education important? So an important part of our enslavement and of the colonization of a people has to do with colonizing their minds. And so, you know, and I'm sure this is no new news to your listeners that, you know, since we've been in this country, there's been a concerted effort to, one, make us docile and teach us not to be rebellious and to accept our condition. There's been that kind of conditioning. But then along with that has been this notion that white people are somehow inherently superior to us and that, you know, somehow we deserve really to be under their foot. And, you know, of course, they're most sophisticated with it now. They don't say it in those terms now, but that's still what it boils down to, that the history of white people, people from Europe, is more significant than the history of people from Africa who came to the so-called Western Hemisphere. So, of course, all of that is false, and it develops within our people a sense of inferiority, a sense of a lack of confidence in ourselves, as Marcus Garvey said. It develops within us a sense that we are diminished, that we are somehow less than white people, that somehow white people have a monopoly, should have a monopoly on defining reality, that somehow, you know, that the ability that all other human beings have to exercise self-determination and define their reality, that somehow, you know, we're not endowed with that. So anyway, all these ideas are in our heads. And then on top of that, we have the lure of modern capitalism. It has all kind of devices and gadgets that's got our young people focused on things that are not really going to move us forward as a people. Let me say, you know, I'm not against telephones and computers and those kind of things. I think we can use them for our liberation. But for the most part, they're being used for vanity. They're being used for entertainment. They're being used for things that are not really developing our humanity and our character. And it's certainly not developing our communities. So we have a big work to do to reclaim the minds of our people and to want to develop a sense of love for ourselves, because self-love is a necessary prerequisite for liberation. If you don't love yourself, then you'll accept being, you know, dominated by white people. If you love yourself, you're not going to accept domination by anybody. And so we have to rekindle that basic self-love within ourselves. And that's the thing that makes our revolution so much different than any of the other revolutions throughout the world, you know, and it's important that we study those revolutions, but no other people was completely taken out of, you know, their sense of self removed from them, you know, and not completely. As hard as they tried, you know, we still, of course, have characteristics of Africa in us because it's in our DNA. But, you know, largely they took our language, our name, forced their language, forced their names on us, forced their religion, forced their distorted version of Christianity, having us look at a European image of so-called Jesus, which, you know, Christianity teaches is the three-in-one God. So this is, you know, our image of the almighty creator of the universe is, you know, we look at a Michelangelo's nephew or whatever. All of these things debilitate our minds and make it impossible for us to struggle for liberation because we don't even have a sense of self-love and a sense of who we are. So African-centered education, firstly, seeks to correct that. Secondly, and I'll say this, that all African-centered education is not the same because it's not all revolutionary. And so we at our school always tried to keep a revolutionary perspective to what we were doing. And so part of our goal was to make sure that our students understood our historical struggle, right? Like all those things you were running down at the beginning of the show, you know, and there's, of course, you know, hundreds and hundreds of other things that we've done, but we need to have an understanding of that, you know, the history of our people in this country has been a history of resistance. You know, they didn't just put chains on us and we just say, yes, sir, boss, we accepting this. It's a history of resistance. And if our children don't know that, then they'll become docile and think that there's no hope for us to be free, proud, and independent. So revolutionary African-centered education has that objective.
Well, cool. Yeah, so I'm glad you presented. I'm glad you put that out there. I'll let it be known. I got a few more questions. Then I'm open like call for line. Open the line for different callers, right?
You know what, brother? Can I say one more thing before you say that? Can I say one more thing?
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, a couple things you mentioned just brought something to mind. You mentioned the RNA 11, and there's a brother in Detroit, a brother Addis Ababa, who also was a member of the RNA 11, and brother Addis or Dennis Shillingford. At one point in 1989, we were making red, black, green African medallions together and had a business. We were, you know, generating pretty nice money doing that. But also, you know, we're still friends, and I still see him from time to time. But also you mentioned a couple of people who said Chokwe gave them their names, and what it brought to mind is there's a sister here in Detroit named Imara Hyman. And Imara tells me that she was in the RNA's office the first time Chokwe walked in there and started inquiring about becoming a member or a conscious citizen of the Republic of New Africa, and that she's the one that actually signed him up. So that history is still alive, still living in Detroit, and she sometimes comes out and volunteers at D-Town Farm. In fact, one day at the farm, Sister Imara was there, and there was another brother named Brother Alfonso Pugh. Alfonso was a New African Legionnaire. He was on duty the night at New Bethel when the police started shooting, and Imara was in the church that night. They both happened to be volunteering at the farm and started talking. I videotaped it, and they didn't even know each other, but they were comparing notes from that night. So I'm saying that to say that history is still alive here in Detroit.
That's a beautiful thing, man. That's a beautiful thing. Wow, I love to hear that. Love to hear that, man. You know, those oral traditions, they keep them prepared for, especially in regard to our griots, man. We always need the information, especially things people who don't experience everything. If you read about or look at documents about, they give a better understanding, give a better perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you know, it's a different form of political education, you know, that you're not going to get in school, you're not going to get in the academic level. So that's a beautiful thing. You know, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask about was, I remember you shared with me that you participate in 1975 New African elections, right? And elections are coming up November 3rd to the field, right? Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I can't tell you a whole lot about the experience except that, again, Chokwe, you know, Chokwe influenced a lot of us. He was like our big brother. So Chokwe signed me up he didn't sign me up, but he, first of all, let me say this. He enlisted me to help publicize the election. So there were posters, and as I think about it, I think that poster had the RNA 11 on the poster also. But you know, he had me and some of my other comrades putting up posters around the city and distributing posters. And, you know, we agreed to do that, and we agreed that we would vote. An election, and you know, he had kind of like an orientation in the basement of his parents' house, actually, and so then there was a few polling places. There weren't a whole lot, but there was one in Highland Park, Michigan, which is kind of a little city inside of Detroit, and a church, and that church had agreed to cooperate with the provisional government on the election, on the national election, and so it was a polling place. So when I went to the polling place, the first thing you had to do is register as a conscious New African citizen, and then you were eligible to vote. And so I registered, I voted, and that's about all I can recall about the election.
Okay. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful
thing. I think that might have been, I can't remember for sure, but that might have been the election when Sister Dara Abubakari was elected. I could be wrong. I could be getting the dates wrong, but.
Yes, it was, because 1975 was that actually was the first election. That were the first ever elections, right? That it had nationally.
Oh, okay.
That was the first one ever. And at that time, that was the time they want to say they gave birth to the two presidents, Sister Abubakari, because he was the vice president at that time. So he was the acting president at that time because Amari was incarcerated. you know, she was the acting president at that time in general. Did the same thing in regards to like when Robert Williams was in exile, he had accepted the presidency, but Guy de Abadeli was a vice president, so he was acting president at that time. He was acting president of the government. You know, so that's the situation, you know, what was going on. But that was the first national election at that time, ever, 1975.
Okay.
That was the first national election.
I graduated from high school the year before. So I was still a youngster for sure.
Okay. And also what you said earlier, Kwame Kenyatta, he was one of the founding members of NAPO, New York People Organization. He was one of the founding members of that as well. Okay.
Kwame and I were very, very, very close. That was my, like, close. We came up in the movement together. And, I was the best man at two of his weddings. That's how close we were. Well, we were very, very, very close. You know, later on, we became not quite as close. He started getting into electoral politics, and, you know, we always remained cool up until he passed. But once he got into electoral politics, we weren't quite, you know, we didn't talk every day like we used to.
Okay. That's understood. My next question is, I understand that you did, you co-led a court called Food Literacy for All at University of Michigan, right? Tell a little bit about that course, and is it available is it available to the masses?
Okay, so some people from the University of Michigan approached me, and I can't remember how many years it was ago, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, something like that, and said that they wanted to write this grant to get some money to teach a course about the food system. And they wanted it to be not just the university, but wanted to have a community partner. And so a lot of people, I had spoken up at University of Michigan a lot of times. A lot of people that knew what I was doing, knew who I was. And so they approached me, and we discussed it. And I was interested because I'm interested in breaking down this idea that universities are where knowledge is contained. And I want to affirm that knowledge is also in the community, and wisdom is in the community, and we just don't value that knowledge and wisdom in the same way. But also, these universities have tremendous resources, and in this case, they were able to bring in speakers to speak to students at University of Michigan, and then often what we're able to do is the next day bring that speaker to Detroit and have that person speak to people who are in our community, people who are doing gardening or farming or whatever. And so I thought it was a good kind of sharing of resources, and it broke down this kind of way that most people view universities. It wasn't exclusive. And even the course itself was open to the community. You could be enrolled in it and a student and get credit for it, or you could be a community member and just come through the course and sit there and learn. Or we broadcast them also and recorded them. And so we had places in Detroit where people could go and sit and watch it as a group, or you could watch it at home on your TV. So we wanted to make sure that this knowledge was being accessible to people in Detroit, in the Black community that we were working with. So, the whole thing is available. The whole series is available online. If you go to University of Michigan and type in Food Literacy for All, they'll come up. But, you know, that's been several years since I did it, and since then, the course continued. In fact, what I did it for 2 years, and then I stepped down and passed it to a sister named Jerry Hebron, who runs a farm in Detroit also. We partner with her a lot. So I'm always trying to be conscious, one, of not trying to be the only voice, because in this society, they want to come up with one or two experts who supposedly have all the knowledge and focus on that one or two people. And so I want to affirm that, you know, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only voice. And so I do it for a while, step down, somebody else come in and do it. But the other thing is I'm working within myself on dismantling patriarchy. And, you know, this is the area that often within the nationalist movement and the Pan-Africanist movement that we're not as strong on as we need to be. And so brothers really have a lot of work to do to make sure that we are, you know, creating spaces for the voices of women to be heard, and that we're consciously creating spaces for women leadership, and that we're developing new women leadership, and that men are relinquishing leadership and encouraging women to step up. So I'm in that process myself, so I wanted to make sure that this Sister Jerry had a chance to have a voice in this whole situation. And then since then, I think another sister became the community partner. So there's probably by this time about 5, 6, 7 years of videos out there. The first 2 years are the years that I was co-leading the course.
Okay. Yes, sir. You know, I would like to acknowledge that, you know, in regards to that, you know, the new African independent movement, you know, we actually and believe and know that you can have a new African nation without a new African woman, right? And throughout the British Republic of Africa, there has been new African women and men that shared the same role and responsibilities. As you mentioned earlier, Sister Dabakar was a president. Now we have a female president now, Sister Samai. You know,
I know, sis.
Yes,
she's
yes,
in
sir.
Memphis, is that right?
Yeah, she's in Memphis. I
yeah,
well,
she's a singer, too.
Yeah, singer, dancer,
all
that
stuff.
I
met her at New African Nation Day in Detroit a few years ago.
Yes, sir, for the 50th anniversary. Yes, sir.
That might have been,
you know,
I can't remember which year it was.
Yeah, you know, no, then you know, also, like, the first minister of defense, was H. Wright Brown, then General Wade Stewart. But we also have female minister of defense, such as Sister Sophia Bakari, Mama Falani Sunil Lee, you know, so forth and so on. So it's always been that understanding that, you know, that it's not sexism. It's always been an equality aspect of our new African independent movement in general. No, I just want to put it out there for the people who are listening.
No, that's good.
You know,
that's good. And that wasn't criticism of the New African Independence Movement in particular. It was a broad criticism.
I wasn't saying it was criticism. I was just putting information out there so people can know.
Okay, cool.
In regards to looking at it.
I got you.
I didn't take it in a criticism, Bob. You know, I was just like putting information out there, you know, so people can
understand
exactly from a historical perspective. Like you look things up, you look at these names, like same names you mentioned, you can look these names up, right, and get a better understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say this
on this same question though, that even when we're doing a good job, there's still it's like racism. Patriarchy is so instilled in us that it's going to be a lifetime work, you know, trying to get these ideas out of our head, and so. You know, I commend the things that you listed that are happening within and have happened historically within the New African Independence Movement, and just would say, and that our men, whether it's in this country or throughout the world, we have a lot of work to do to get some of these ideas out of our head about the superiority of men, or that men are supposed to be leading, and all these kind of ideas that are keeping us held back.
True indeed. You know, my next question is, we understand that this September is Black Reading Month, right? And so I understand you wanted to co-founders of this situation. Give us a little insight about this month and exactly why did that transpire? Give us the origin behind it.
Okay, in 1978-79, myself and some of my comrades had a little business called New Directions Information and Communications Institute. And we were doing several things, trying to pump Black consciousness in our community. And so there were certain things we were publishing, little one-page things about Black nationalist leaders that, you know, people could read quickly. And we were also distributing books and magazines. We were buying books from Third World Press, and then we would resell those books, and we would get in Conscious Black magazines, and we would take them around to stores in the community, leave them on consignment, and come back at the end of the month. They would pay us for whatever was sold, and we would take the rest back, and then we'd send the rest back to the distributor, and we'd get a credit for it. But what we found is that although we were putting these Conscious Black publications in stores in the Black community, black people weren't buying them. And so we decided that we needed to do something to raise the consciousness within our community about the importance of reading books, magazines, and journals by black authors, and also hopefully published by black people also, again, going back to this idea of circular economies, so that, you know, we're not just writing the book, but we're also publishing the book, and the money being made from it is circulating within our community. So that was really what started it, wanting to push a campaign to get people to buy more books and magazines. And so we partnered, the first year was in 1980, we partnered with different people in Detroit. There were a couple of black publishers here, like Lotus Press and Broadside Press, and the Detroit Public Library partnered with us and Detroit Public Schools. And so we would have book fairs in the early days. We had book fairs and lectures and all kind of things happening throughout the month of September, really to promote the idea that in order for us to really, again, going back to the idea of self-knowledge, that we can't wage a struggle for freedom if we don't know if we're not grounded in our own history and our own culture. And so we have to, it's imperative that we read the literature, for example, that came out of the 1960s. We need to know about the Black Panther Party. We need to know about the Black Liberation Army. We need to know about the New African Independence Movement. We need to know about the things before that, the Deacons for Defense, for Robert Williams. We need to know all these things. And the way we know them is by reading the things that have been written by the people who participated or who documented these things. And so in every revolution, you know, particularly looking at the Cuban Revolution, an important part of it was the literacy campaign that, you know, you can't really build a new society with people who have not transformed their thinking. And so one of the things that capitalism tries to do to us is make us ahistorical, to forget about the past, not really have any knowledge of the past. And if you don't have knowledge of the past, you can't understand the conditions that we're faced with today. And so Black Reading Month was really rooted in all those ideas that in order for us to change our condition today, we have to understand, you know, our cultural legacy, and reading books, magazines, and journals written by Black authors is an important way of doing that. So over the years, the participation has diminished. You know, the big institutions that we had, like the Detroit Public Library and Detroit Public Schools, they're no longer participating. And really the tradition has been kept alive by a small crew of people basically in Detroit. In the African-centered schools here, you know, the one I ran was closed and a couple others are closed, but we kept it alive for, you know, 20, 30 years. And then there's a school in Detroit now called Barack Obama Leadership Academy that they're having Black Reading Month activities. There's another community institution that's doing it. So it's still alive in Detroit, but not being celebrated as widely as it was. Now, 4 years ago, because of the pandemic, or starting in 2020, we went online and started doing online what we call author talks, finding black writers who we thought were important writers and interviewing them on video where people can tune in and listen to the conversation. And then for the last half an hour, the viewers can also ask questions or make comments to the guests. So we've continued that for the last 4 years. So we have one tomorrow night, as a matter of fact, the first one. We're only doing two this year. The first one is my brother Michael Simanga, who is from Detroit. And Michael Simanga, back in the day, his name was Pili Sababu, and he was a lieutenant of Amiri Baraka in the Congress of African People. And he, in fact, now he's an academic. He has a PhD, and he's written a book, an important book about Amiri Baraka. But he was very much in the thick of things with CAP, with the National Black Political Party. He was there in Gary, Indiana. And so he has this tremendous history of struggle himself. And he was also very close to Shokwe. But he moved, as many people did, moved to the South, to the national territory to try to focus activities there. And so he's been in Atlanta since the 1980s. But he will be interviewing two sisters who are the editors of a magazine called Merge Magazine. And so that's tomorrow at 7. Then the second author talk we have is on Wednesday, September 27th. And my good sister, Akwete Taihimba, who is the owner of the Pan-African Connection Bookstore in Dallas, is going to be talking to Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Gerald Horn is the author of more than 20 books. He's a historian. He has a very sharp analysis. He's a Marxist. I'm not a Marxist myself, but I think, you know, we can't dismiss Marxism, and there's some value in the Marxist analysis. But Dr. Horn is going to be the guest that week. So we want people to tune in and, you know, learn what they can from these writers and to celebrate Black Reading Month. One of the other aspects, and then I'll wrap this point up, of Black Reading Month is what we call the Turn Off the TV campaign. And we encourage people to go for the month of September without watching television, to do a fast of sorts from television. And, you know, it's for some people fast during Black August also, and so it kind of, you know, kind of can segue into, you know, fasting from TV in September. And part of that is just to develop our own discipline, because we cannot wage a struggle for liberation against the biggest superpower in the world without discipline. And so if we are just a victim, if we're dragged around the world by our desires and the need for stimulation, then we won't be too successful. So we have to learn how to exert discipline, and going for a month without watching TV is a form of discipline. But also we can then reallocate that time that we spend watching TV. You know, and many people spend 1, 2, 3, 4 hours a day watching TV. Instead of doing that, we can now pick up a book and read at least one Black book during the month of September. And so September was chosen because at the time we started Black Reading Month, September was the peak book buying month for the book industry. And that's mainly because that's when students were going back to school. And so we've kept it there at the beginning of the school year, and it's a good way to start off the school year. And, you know, the thing about Black Reading Month is we're saying reading is important, but not just reading in general. What's important is that we read books that are reflecting our own culture and our own heritage.
Yes, sir. And I appreciate that. You know, at this time, I'll let open a line up for a few callers. If you have any comment, questions, statements, or announcements, feel free to one at a time. If you have any questions, comments, or statements, or announcements, feel free to one at a time. I'll open your line up. If you have any questions, comments, or statements, feel free to one at a time. Open your line up. Again, Bob, I want to thank you for coming to the broadcast. You know, we show you how to understand and share your experiences, right? Also for your keeping the work that you're presenting and kicking it, right? Matter of fact, I got one more question, right? Yes, sir. When you hear the name George Jackson, what did that mean to you?
It means a lot of things, and one of the things, of course, it means to me is, or that it brings to mind, is Jonathan Jackson. And I was listening to the clips he played at the beginning. And, you know, they had in the movie, the reenactment of the situation with Jonathan Jackson in the courthouse. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember that. I read about that. I heard about it and read about it in the Black Panther newspaper. You know, at that time, the Panthers were selling newspapers downtown in downtown Detroit. And I would go downtown frequently and, you know, buy papers and read them, and that was my way kind of staying current on revolutionary politics. So that had a big impact on me, you know, as a young man myself. You know, I might have been 15, something like that at that time. And so, you know, seeing this young brother, one, being that courageous, and two, just seeing how ruthless the state was, you know, that they even killed their own judge. They didn't care about him, you know. So all that came to mind when you mentioned the name George Jackson, but also the tremendous fortitude, revolutionary fortitude, in the face of the deepest types of oppression, in the belly of the beast, to still be uncompromisingly revolutionary and to be influencing people not only in the joint but people outside, is just a tremendous testament, you know, to his strength. And then also, you know, the tremendous injustice, and, you know, this was mentioned in the film clip also, of, you know, what he was in prison for in the first place, supposedly, you know, some minor theft. you know, the fact that our people have been rendered in, you know, in poverty throughout this country, and most black men and women who are in prison are in prison for some economic crime. They're in prison for doing something to get some money. And the reason that we don't have enough money, we don't have enough resources, is because we live in a colonial-like situation where our resources are being sucked out and extracted, and even our mental resource, even our brain power, is being sucked out and used for our oppressor, not for our own development. So all of those things come to mind when I hear Comrade George's name.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I appreciate that, you know. Yes, sir. Americana Courthouse. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
That was a beautiful thing, man. You know, I want to add on, you know, you mentioned Black August earlier, right? Previously, you know, Black August is in the month of August the 31st, right? That Black Opposition is year-wide, 365 days. So from the beginning of September the 3rd, all the way to July 31st, the Black Opposition. And like you stated earlier, you know, we want the youth to know that we have resisted throughout time, from the very that time of NYV, from the very slavery building, from the very aspect we want to establish the independent city and town, the maroon villages, the Dismal Swamp, so forth and so on, where we have resisted, right? And that even to the aspect of Milton Cabral gaining independence, Cape Verde again, and beside, you know, all those places gain independence, you know, they're doing those times, Jamaica, so forth and so on. You know, we want to know, let the people know that we got a form of resistance. While you being, our new African identity has been in resistance. Our culture of resistance, right? I just wanted to say that.
I appreciate that.
I appreciate you saying, you know, I'm going to try to open a couple of lines. Hold up. Hold on right quick. Your line, if you got any questions, comments, statements, go ahead on. 443-206, your line is open. If you have any questions, comments, statements. 443-206, your line is open here. Any questions, comments, statements? Okay. Okay, let me move to another person. Okay. 616-285, your line is open. Any question, comment, or statement? 614-285, your line is open. Any question, comment, or statement or now? Your line is open. Fire, your line is open. Keep on to the next. See, your line is open. If you got any question, comment, or statement, 478-206, your line is open. If you got any comment, statements, or questions. Okay. 706-594, your line is open. If you got any question, comment, or statement. 706-594, your line is open. If you got any question, comment, or statement. Please do sit at time. I'm going to ask another question then. What exactly is the movement Urban Roots and Tomorrow? And what also, also what is Urban, what is Urban Garden, what you mentioned? What is that?
Mm-hmm. So urban agriculture, urban gardens is just agriculture that's done in the city. You know, most of us traditionally think about agriculture being in the countryside, in the rural area, which still most of it happens. But what, you know, if we look at demographics of human population, 100 years ago, most people lived in rural areas. Now, most people live in metropolitan areas throughout the world. And so it makes more sense to grow food closer to where you have centers of population density rather than moving food hundreds of thousands of miles to where you got these concentrations of population. And so in cities where we have, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people, it makes sense to grow as much of that food as we can near where people are for two reasons. One, it's better for the environment. You're not spewing carbon into the atmosphere by transporting it thousands of miles. And two, it's better for human health. If you eat something, you know, 2 hours ago, it's much more nutrient dense than if you eat something that was picked 3 weeks ago in California and put into a truck and hauled across the country. It was picked when it was unripe, hauled across the country. Maybe some gas was shot into the truck to keep it from ripening, and then you get it 3 weeks later. It doesn't have the same nutrient density. And so urban agriculture is growing food in cities. In terms of those two movies, frankly, I wouldn't necessarily recommend either one of them. Urban Roots was a movie some people made about urban agriculture in Detroit, which, you know, I mean, it was okay. It's not really – it's some outsiders trying to tell our story. I'll put it like that. And so I'm in the movie, and hopefully I brought some degree of clarity. But the real story of Detroit urban agriculture has to be told by the black people here who are doing it, not by some white people who drop in for 3 or 4 days and shoot some footage. So that's what that was. The movie yesterday, to tell you the truth, I haven't even seen it. It was a French film producer who came out to our farm and shot some footage, and I'm in it. And then the guy who was our farm manager at the time produced and did hip-hop, and so they used one of his tracks on the movie. But I frankly haven't seen the movie.
Okay. My last question is, like, if people want to listen to your music or listen to your band, how can they find out about your band? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the band is called Molly Wop, and Molly Wop, you know, is slang that basically means to smack somebody upside their head. And so this is what we're doing metaphorically, smacking people upside their head, trying to get people to wake up. And so, but we do it, you know, we try to do it in a way that's fun and entertaining, because one of the things I learned is that when people come to a concert or come to a club, they're not really looking to come for political lectures, to tell you the truth. And if you try to drag them into that, you go turn them off. And so what we try to do is combine this revolutionary consciousness and to speak to our conditions, speak to what we see in our community, but to do it in a way that has a funky beat that'll have people dance and that can kind of capture people's attention. And so that's what Molly Wop does. So people can check us out at our website, which is www.mollywopjams.com, and it's spelled MOLLYWOPJAMS, mollywopjams.com. We're also on Facebook under Molly Wop. We're on Instagram under Molly Wop Jams, but on Instagram, the Jams is spelled J-A-M-Z. And so people can check us out. They can go to YouTube and put Molly Wop in there. Make sure, though, you put the Molly Wop with the exclamation mark after it, because there's some other Molly Wops that's talking about some foul stuff and degrading women and things like that. And I want to make sure people know that's not us. But we're all over any Apple Music, Spotify, any way people get their music, they can check us out.
Okay, I appreciate it. Again, I want to thank you for coming to the broadcast. I said, I understand it, you know, and thank you for the time, the work you're doing in the past, the work you're doing in the present, the work you're doing in the future. At this time, I'd like to leave with your final thought, what you want to leave us with, your final thought. Give us your final thought, what you want to leave us with.
Well, my final thought would be that we have to realize our own divinity, if you want to use that word. You know, African culture has always affirmed that the essential part of us is a spiritual part. And we have to affirm our own divinity. And once we affirm that, we won't let anything, anybody oppress us. And we will manifest the fullness of who we were created to be. You know, and I would say we have the responsibility, you know, this is the way I look at it. That clearly all science indicates that black people were the first people on the earth. You know, Elijah Muhammad used to say the black man is the original man. And, you know, people say, oh, what he know? He only went to the fifth grade or whatever. But all of Western science, all the archaeological evidence confirms that the earliest human beings dawned into consciousness in East Central Africa. And so the thing about it, though, is being the first, I don't think necessarily makes us the best. I think what it does is it gives us more responsibility. We're first, so we're the template of what humanity is supposed to be. And so I think we need to step up to our true purpose, manifest the fullness of who we were created to be, develop all of our geniuses, and by doing developing the genius within ourselves, within our community, we advance ourselves, we better ourselves, but we also contribute to the development of humanity. That's all I got.
Okay. I appreciate it. I got a person who want to say something, right? So let me open the line up.
All right.
Brother, you're here. Your line is open. So you got a question, comment, say the line is open. Go ahead. Brother, you hear your line is open. Go ahead, brother.
Peace.
Your line is open, bro. Okay, go ahead.
Peace and blessings.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I appreciate everything that's been said, and I hope I understand everything correctly. It's great to just sit down and listen to my elders talk about something I'm so passionately about. I can recall sitting down in my living room studying one day, and I heard the voice of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan when he was on Donahue come on the television. And that catapulted my life. It changed the whole dynamics of my life. My son Joaquin was about to be born at that time. I was about to go into the military at that time. And great events like that only happens in a person's life once or twice in a person's life. And I'll never forget that day when I heard that man say, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful, it just something just shook inside of me. And every time I hear you speak, Baba, it kind of reminds me of that day, because revolution has always been my life. We don't come out the womb easy and gentle. I know I didn't. I came out screaming, kicking, and fighting, and my mother was too. She was a 13-year-old child. So when I came out, it was a blessing, but it was a struggle. And life has always been a struggle for me, you know. And to know that this mantle is not just carried by myself, it gives me courage, and it gives me an inner strength. I can sit down and follow these conversations. I tell you all the time, man, I can sit here and listen to you talk. You know, a lot of people on Sunday, they'll turn on the gospel music, and they'll get the spirit. And the night before, they was out drinking and raising more hell than a little bit. But when I sit here and listen to you and the Bible speak about our struggle, getting knocked down and having the grit to get back up, man, it's just something that just inspires me to a whole nother level. You know my situation. I'm in the belly of the beast fighting, and I have to fight every day, man. You know, warfare is not just a physical armed struggle. You know, it's on so many different levels. And it's our duty. I say, what is the duty of a civilized person? To teach he who established civilization, righteousness, the knowledge of himself, and the science of everything in life, love, peace, and happiness. And I carry that mantle, everything and everything I do. You know, but what is civilization? We've been mistaught that civilization came from Europe, when these were the most uncivilized people to ever walk the face of the planet Earth. How do we correct that? Well, the first thing we need to do, my father told me, he said, Malik, never condemn a dirty glass. Just put a clean glass next to it. He said, work your whole life on being a clean glass. So first, we got to civilize ourselves. And in the Quran, it says, Ikra, bismira ikalati kalak, read. Read in the name of thy Lord and cherish. And many of us can't read. We can't read the signs of life. We can't read the signs of struggle. We can't read the signs of love. And it manifests in our house where we can't get along with our woman, we can't get along with our children, and we can't even get along with ourselves. We go to work, can't get along with nobody there, because it's a disturbance, it's a dis-peace, a dis-ease in the way we move. I haven't eaten flesh other than fish in at least 35 years, man. And I tell you, it would make a difference. Because they say a savage is a person who has lost the knowledge of himself and lives a beast way of life. What you put inside your body, it manifests. It manifests in everything you do. And eating more healthy, eating more conscious, even regardless of my circumstances. Some people say, how do you do it? This ain't something that's for the weak, for somebody who's going to get knocked down and lay down. This revolutionary thing is for the strong. I told my wife the other day, I said, revolutionary is a lonely thing, man. Because you're going to find yourself with only a few. It's not by yourself most of the time because everybody ain't attuned to this. You have to be attuned to this. This is not something that, you know, you're going to get overnight. You're going to get knocked down, beaten, dragged, and you still going to learn. You still going to learn. You still going to learn. So when I hear you brothers go through your struggles, have the courage and the love for our people to lay yourself bare in front of all of us like this and tell your stories, I humble myself, man, and I appreciate y'all greatly for this. And
brother, I appreciate you sharing what you shared, and everything that came out of your mouth sounded like 100% truth to me.
Yes, sir.
When I see older brothers like you, you know, you're my father's age. You know, and I know what my father went through. You know, my father battled a drug addiction, man, and I've seen that man beat that, and that's one of the hardest things in the world to beat. But the only thing I know harder to beat than drug addiction is the lack of knowledge of yourself. That is a monster you have to fight with everything you have. But you got to have a starting point. You got to have somebody to take your hand and give you a little bit of light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got so much competition out there, man. BET, YouTube, IG, you know. It's a lot out there, man, that we're competing against. I just wish that it was an outlet for our people. You know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, come out of her. You know, and the Pan-African thing has always been my dream. I want to go to places, you know, America, it's so expensive right now. It's very difficult to do anything. And then they sanction everything, and this is how they control our movement. By law, or they control land, air, and water, and everything that we do for commerce, because they don't ever want you to be able to control your own mode of production. You know, the ability to produce for yourself is the desire of every man. How we choose to do it, that's a personal choice. You know, I've seen some brothers take a less share of the portions on the table to make sure their wife and children eat. Then I seen some brothers get paid on Friday nights, stop at the liquor store to cash their check, because they messed their bank account up. They can't go to the bank and deposit their check. They got to go to the liquor store and cash it. Then he going to get him a half a liter of gin there, some blunts. He called the weed man to meet him in the parking lot. So he's taken away from his family before he even got home and handed his wife anything. And some men don't even want to hand their wife nothing. Like your brother said, we got to change that mentality, man. This subservient woman, this man got to lead. Women have been some of the greatest fighters that we've ever seen. I know my mother fought. My mother was 12 years old. You know what I mean? People told her to get rid of me. People that was close to her. She fought every last one of them. And here I stand. I'm not where I want to be, but I know that I exist and I have a chance to be better.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to wrap this up, man, and I want to say thank you to you brothers, man. More money, please, brother, keep doing what you're doing. It's September, and we want to read black books and black history. There's a great book out right now written, it's called The Blood Saga. One of my personal friends wrote this book. It's a great book. Please go out and support him, man, and support these brothers that are out here choosing not to sell your baby's poison, you know, support them. Show them that you appreciate that, you know. And I yield, brother. Peace and blessings and freedom land.
Freedom land, thank you for calling, brother.
Mighty me and that's fair, bro. Appreciate. Yeah, Bob, we got late. 7 minutes left, man. You got anything else you want to leave us with before we end? Anything else you want to say?
No, that was the last word I shared a little while ago. I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Okay. You know, I want to say, you know, we want to encourage everybody to read all the new African books he's saying this month. Support our new African book businesses. Buy new African books. Educate the youth as much as possible. If possible, buy some books to give them to the youth. Give them to the children. You know, read to the children. Things of that nature. Right. We encourage you to do that. To educate for liberation. And also, if you have any comrade, little one, who's my enemy, live, please check out Jordan University. You can be found on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram for the name Jordan University. We also have a website, which is www.jordanuniversity.gdu.com. And also that if you know anybody behind enemy lines, please write them, reach out to them, send them pictures. If you know a political prisoner or you're trying to know a political prisoner, you can reach out to Jordan University. You also can find a prisoner, write him, he or she, start a campaign and see what kind of support they need. And also, there's campaigns going around for the release of one of our founder, Abdul Lugabai Securities, that you can find online. Also, our vice chancellor, Joker Shima Jensei, who are both current new African political prisoners in California. I'm going to say Law New African Independent Movement, Law New African Guerrilla, and the struggle for awful land and independence, free the land.